Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I bet you can guess what I'm going to start with today. Yeah, it's oil, up $5. Hey, could have been 10. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity. Online at us.areva.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Wednesday, the 11th of June. Great to have you here. And I do hate to be the bearer of bad tidings, but the government of the United States had this to say today about high oil and gas prices. Deal with it. At a hearing on Capitol Hill, an official from the Energy Department said gas is going to stay close to $4 a gallon through next year. Oil is going to average about $1.26 a barrel, and there ain't much Uncle Sam can do about it. From Washington, Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
For the Democrats, the solution is a switch to alternative fuels. Congressman Jay Inslee posed this question to Guy Caruso today. Caruso heads the Energy Department's statistical agency.
What is the assumption we have of the percentage of our private cars that can be either electrified or based largely on domestically produced substitute fuels in the next 20 years?
Our current assumption is 45% of the new car sales in 2030 would be what we call alternatively fueled vehicles.
That includes hybrids, turbo diesel, and flex fuel cars. Republicans called for more domestic drilling, but Rushir Kadakia at Cambridge Energy Research Associates says that won't impact prices significantly.
The problems that got us to $140 oil today aren't going to be fixed by drilling. And yeah, it might alleviate some of the problem, but you're just going to pent it up and, you know, shift it back a few years.
Lehman Brothers energy analyst James Crandall says an oil production boost could help somewhat in the near term. But as for the big transition, changing people's habits.
The American car fleet's very large. It's 300 million cars or so. So it takes a lot of time for a complete turnover to a more efficient car fleet.
One piece of good news, Crandall says modest U.S. fuel efficiency increases are likely to keep demand here flat for years. And that, he says, could curb those oil prices a bit. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Energy Secretary Sam Bodman probably wants to curb oil prices as much as anybody. And to that end, Bodman said today he'll be heading to Saudi Arabia in a couple of weeks for that meeting the Saudis are hosting, the one that's supposed to strike some kind of balance between oil users and producers. You think we've got it tough with rising oil prices driving inflation? Get a load of the May wholesale inflation report out of China this morning. Beijing says its producer price index jumped 8.2% last month. That's a 12-year high. Prices in India are rising more than 8% a year as well. And public protests over the costs of necessities have broken out from Malaysia to Portugal. Inflation here is nowhere near double digits, but our Washington bureau chief John Dimsdale reports it's still no time to be smug.
The U.S. is importing global inflation thanks in part to a weak dollar that makes foreign products and commodities more expensive. And the Federal Reserve's cuts in interest rates to cushion the blow of the subprime mortgage crisis fuel even more inflation. Bank of America economist Mickey Levy.
There's no question it has helped the economy, but it's not costless. And one of the costs has been a weaker dollar that's put upward pressure on oil prices and prices of commodities and raw materials, and the Fed knows that.
Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke last week acknowledged the dollar's low value has sparked inflation, and that signaled the Fed's next move will be upwards. For a while, Bernanke's comments strengthened the dollar and oil prices began to drop. But a day later, the head of the European Central Bank, Jean-Claude Trichet, told reporters he may soon raise European rates. The prospect of higher returns in Europe undermined the dollar and oil shot to record levels. Fed watcher David Jones thinks the ECB president has the wrong inflation-fighting prescription.
If Mr. Trichet follows through on his threat at the next meeting to raise rates, it will cause perhaps a deeper recession in Europe, in my view, than we have had in the U.S.
The Fed would like to delay stepping on the economic brake since banks are still writing off bad mortgage loans. But inflation pressures at home and abroad will bring higher interest rates sooner rather than later. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Inflation was mentioned prominently in the Federal Reserve's Beige Book today. That's the Fed's once every 6 week study of the economy broken down by region. It said businesses are having mixed luck at best in passing on their rising prices to consumers. The sagging economy has been tough on a lot of retailers, an issue also reflected in the Beige Book. But the gap has fallen on especially rough times. Sales last month were down 8% over a year ago. And back then, it wasn't doing so well either. The company's held things together this far by cutting costs. And Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio. It's planning another big squeeze.
That old Gap slogan, fall into the gap, has never been easier to do. There's Gap, Gap Body, Gap Maternity. All told, the company has more than 31,000 stores. That includes Old Navy and Banana Republic brands. But still, that's a lot of Gap. Retail strategist Wendy Liebman calls it brand saturation.
They just keep cannibalizing themselves. They're on every other corner, and that creates a tremendous amount of sameness.
So Gap's going to downsize. Beginning this year, spin-offs like Baby Gap will merge into existing Gap stores. The annual rent reductions could be substantial, but retail consultant Howard Davidowitz says Gap will go nowhere till it increases sales.
Gap is not a survivable company unless they can excite the customer and drive more footsteps into these stores.
Gap sales have declined for at least 15 straight quarters. Critics complain Gap's forgotten its core customer, 25 to 35, graduating from beer to wine. But Simon Dunit, creative director for Barney's New York, says selling fashion to the masses requires a crystal ball.
If you're too funky one season, you turn off all the slightly conservative people in you who are potentially coming to the Gap. If you're too frumpy and too safe, then the groovy people don't come.
Gap says it'll return to its roots this year. It wants to be known as the Trader Joe's of clothing, modern basics on a budget. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
The question of the day on Wall Street today was the one John Dimsdale left us with. What is going on inside the mind of Ben Bernanke? And when traders don't know the answer on interest rates, we wind up with the sad music. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Next time you want to impress somebody with arcane economic trivia, you could just happen to let it drop in a conversation that the biggest trading relationship the U.S. has with another country isn't with China or Japan. It's Canada, almost $1 billion a day. If you lump all the European Union countries together, though, the EU's the biggest, and the economic fate of that union could hinge on a vote tomorrow in Ireland. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard explains.
Ireland is the only EU member state required by its constitution to hold this referendum. The vote is on the Lisbon Treaty, a measure designed to streamline the machinery of the EU. And boy, does it need streamlining, says analyst Graham Mather.
It's rather like driving a 15-year-old car. The whole thing is beginning to collapse.
But the treaty is controversial. It's the second attempt at a new constitution that would unify Europe. Some Irish people fear it would force them to bring their tax rates into line with the rest of the EU. Philip White is with the Centre for European Reform.
Ireland's economic success has largely been built on attracting foreign direct investment, primarily in the shape of US companies. US companies, however, have partly been attracted to Ireland because Ireland has a low rate of corporation tax.
Supporters of the treaty say the Irish opponents are mistaken. It won't affect their tax rates, so US companies based in Ireland need not worry either. In fact, claims Graham Mather, the US would be better off if the Irish vote yes and the Lisbon Treaty comes into force.
Trade negotiations should be slightly easier. All sorts of policy discussions, whether they're on financial services regulation or avoiding global economic crises, all of those things should be easier, and that would help the United States.
If the Irish say no, however, the treaty cannot take effect and the EU will be plunged into disarray. Opinion polls show that tomorrow's vote could go either way. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
With 7 months left in the Bush administration, time is running out on some of the president's priorities. Free trade is one of them. The White House is waiting on Congress to approve a couple of big trade deals, one with South Korea, another with Colombia. The Colombian trade minister, Luis Plata, is in Washington this week. He's lobbying lawmakers for their vote to approve the treaty that the White House signed almost 2 years ago. Congressional Democrats have shown no signs of changing their minds about the deal, even though analysts say most of the provisions seem to favor the United States. When I spoke with Luis Plata earlier this week, I asked him about that perception.
Well, I think it's a fair deal, actually. We've spent a lot of time negotiating this deal because it gives access to Colombian products to the U.S. on a regular basis. And this is important because this is really what drives investment, and that's the key to any trade deal. It's not just to sell more of what you have, but to actually drive investment. More people, both Colombian and foreign, will invest as we have a trade deal that is stable in time and that is not unilateral, but it's actually a relationship of partnership with the U.S. Given its importance, you know, at some point this year, hopefully will be approved.
As I'm sure you're aware, we've got this election coming up in this country in November. Does it concern you at all, that deadline?
No, actually, I think what's challenging in an election year is that people are thinking about different issues, and things like a trade deal with Colombia, or for that matter, any other country, are not the priority. You know, I think once we get past the elections, I think it'll be a better time to take up on those issues again.
Even if it's a President Obama with a democratically controlled both houses of Congress?
I think it's a deal that's important both to Colombia and to the U.S., not only on its economic merits, but also on its political merit. And Colombia happens to be the main ally for the U.S. and the hemisphere. And I think it's only fair that we get a deal such as Mexico, such as Central America, Peru, and even Chile have these days.
What's the perception in Colombia of American politicians who want to impose labor standards and human rights and other conditions on trade deals that they make?
Well, I think for us Colombians, we don't really understand what this means because, you know, why should somebody else be more concerned about domestic issues and domestic problems that Colombians have than Colombians themselves? You know, it's like me telling you to watch out and care for your family. I'm sure I don't have to tell you this because, you know, to no one is it more dear than to you, your own family. So we feel quite surprised, you know, that somebody would think, well, you know, Colombia should protect their environment, or Colombia should protect their labor rights, because we Colombians are the ones who should be concerned about those things. And as a matter of fact, we are concerned about those things and we're working on those things, but not because somebody else says that we have to or because somebody considers that we ought to be doing that, but because those are the right things to do. That's what we got elected for, was to protect the Colombians, to protect worker rights, to pursue those who commit crimes and not tolerate impunity, and certainly to protect the environment.
Luis Plata is the Colombian Minister of Trade and Industry. Mr. Plata, thanks for your time.
Hi, thank you so much. Thank you for your questions.
John McCain and Barack Obama seem to have settled right into their general election campaign groove, bashing each other on the issue of the day. This week, it's the economy. Commentator David Frum says the economy of this year's campaign is going to have lasting political effects.
Barack Obama has proven himself the most successful fundraiser in American political history. As of the end of April, he had received more than $270 million in donations. Hillary Clinton had raised not quite $220 million, John McCain, not even $100 million. Having raised almost three times as much money as McCain, Obama has placed almost nine times as many TV ads. Okay, well, Obama had to wage a primary race stretching into June, while McCain clinched his nomination months ago. So maybe McCain's conserving cash and keeping his powder dry? Up to a point, yes. But despite the bruising internal Democratic struggle, Obama ended the month of April with twice as much cash on hand as McCain. The Grand Old Party is a massive, hierarchical organization that has always taken for granted an ability to mobilize more resources than its opponents, like the U.S. Army, or Microsoft, or the New York Yankees. But in 2004, the Democrats equaled Republicans in fundraising, and this year, the Democrats have pulled far ahead. A Republican presidential campaign under fundraising constraints is like the Yankees under a salary cap. It does not make a very convincing, scrappy little underdog. Where did the Republicans' money go? Historically, the Democrats relied on comparatively few big donors on the East and West Coasts, while the Republicans relied on small-dollar gifts obtained from hot-button issue direct mail. But as the Republicans have lost their way, they have lost their small donor base. And many of the big donors give only when they expect a candidate to win and return the favor. For these self-interested donors, an investment in the GOP looks only marginally more attractive than countrywide stock. Back when the Republicans were dominant, many Democrats attributed the GOP's success to its financial clout. One lesson of this remarkable year? Yes, political money is necessary to political success. But it's also true that political success produces political money.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His latest book is called Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. Take a second to send us your thoughts, conservative or otherwise. Our website is marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on that link that says Contact. Coming up, the costs and benefits of free Wi-Fi.
I mean, anyone who says that, you know, oh, well, this should be this benevolent thing that the city does, well, that's great, but somebody has to pay for that.
But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, the wah-wah trombones. The Dow crumbled 205 points today, 1 2/3% to 12,083. The Nasdaq fell 54 points. That's 2 1/4%, 2,394. The S&P 500 fell 22 points, 1 2/3%, 1,335, the number there. Washington Mutual, the largest U.S. savings and loan, tumbled 9 1/4% today. Merrill Lynch sank 6.5%. Lehman Brothers lost 13 6/10%. Goldman Sachs even fell. It fell 2 8/10%. Ticker symbol Bud, that's Anheuser-Busch, rose 2% today to about $59, and that was before the company confirmed an unsolicited bid from Belgian brewer InBev. That offer came in at $65, so look out tomorrow. Bonds gained. The yield on the benchmark 10-year T-note fell to 4.07%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. Every day's marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for May. The Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee examines the relationship between U.S. renewable fuels policy and food prices. And complaints about crazy cell phone fees may get rerouted. The Federal Communications Commission holds a hearing to discuss regulating early termination fees. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Now that the subprime horse is gone, the Securities and Exchange Commission set about closing the barn door today. It took aim at the credit rating business with a series of proposed reforms that are supposed to prevent one of the things that got us into the credit crunch from ever happening again. Moody's, Fitch, and Standard & Poor's handing out top ratings to bonds that were backed by subprime mortgages, only to see those bonds collapse as mortgage defaults soared. Marketplace's Amy Scott is on the SEC beat today. Hi, Amy.
Hey, Kai.
So what happened today that the SEC did?
Well, many of the reforms they proposed involve conflicts of interest and transparency. If the rules are approved, rating agencies wouldn't be allowed to help structure the bond deals that they rate. They'd also have to publicly disclose the information they use in determining their ratings so that others can go back and check their work. And analysts won't be allowed to accept gifts from issuers worth more than $25. There was kind of a cute discussion about whether, you know, coffee and Danishes are allowed. But one of the biggest proposals concerns the difference between plain vanilla corporate bonds like IBM and what are known as structured securities. These are bonds backed by pools of subprime mortgages and the like. And that's where the rating agencies really got into trouble, by treating these structured securities like any other bonds, when, of course, they turned out to be a lot riskier. So the SEC has proposed a few ways of dealing with this. Ratings for structured securities either would have to be accompanied by a report outlining the risks, or the securities would actually get a different label. So instead of a AAA credit rating, you might see triple star or something like that.
Gotta love that after billions lost in the subprime squeeze, it comes down to coffee and donuts, right?
That's right.
Let me ask you this, though. Wouldn't some smart investor, whether it's an institutional investor or somebody sitting at home, look at a rating on a product that somehow delineates that it's a structured finance thing and run screaming for the hills, right?
Well, that is one concern. In fact, one commissioner, Paul Atkins, voted against that proposal. The worry is that a separate rating scale could be confusing on one hand, but also by sort of branding these securities with a scarlet letter, it could spook investors and cause them to dump these securities into a market that's already very leery of them, which would basically make this whole credit crunch even worse.
Mm-hmm. What kind of discussion was there of the business model that Standard & Poor's and Moody's and Fitch all employ, which is to say they are paid generally by the entities whose products, whose bonds and offerings they are rating?
Right. That's often described as, a restaurant paying for a review and only paying if it's a good review. There was some discussion of managing that conflict. Analysts involved in rating bonds, for example, would be banned from any discussion of fees. And last week, the New York Attorney General tried to address that conflict in a settlement with the big three agencies. Now bond issuers will have to pay any agency that reviews a deal, not just the firm chosen to rate the deal. And that's meant to reduce the incentive to boost ratings in order to attract business.
Is this real reform, or are they just putting window dressing on it to make it look like they're actually doing something?
I think people that I've spoken to say these are some of the most real reforms we've seen yet. I think the idea is that there is a lot more that can be done, but we've seen the agencies themselves propose reforms. We saw the New York Attorney General come up with a plan last week. International regulators have proposed various voluntary codes of conduct. And I think the idea is that the SEC reforms may actually have some teeth, but it remains to be seen.
Marketplace's Amy Scott in New York City. Thanks, Amy.
Anytime.
$2 years and $17 million later, wireless internet in Philadelphia is scheduled to expire tomorrow. The city had grand plans for what it hoped would be a national model for what's called municipal Wi-Fi, high-speed internet, pretty much anywhere in the city, for a fee if you could afford it, free if you couldn't. But Earthlink, the internet service provider that won the contract, couldn't get the numbers to add up in a way that would make them money on the deal. So tomorrow it's going to pull the plug. But Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports the promise of free municipal Wi-Fi isn't dead yet.
It's a sunny day on the 3rd Street Promenade in Santa Monica, California. The popular outdoor shopping area is packed with musicians, skateboarders, and shoppers. And everywhere you look, people are on their laptops. The city offers free internet access here. Law student Bud Jerky says that's why he came.
Yeah, I'm doing emailing and G-chatting with friends, instant messaging.
This was supposed to be the scene in cities like Philadelphia, San Francisco, and Portland. They all teamed up with private companies to blanket their cities with Wi-Fi. The idea was to give low-income residents free access to the internet and attract businesses. One after another, the projects failed.
It was building a model on shifting sand.
Consultant Craig Settles works with cities to develop municipal internet systems. He says the problem has been the business model. In Philadelphia's case, Earthlink covered the cost of setting up the $17 million network and charged a nominal fee for the service. The company was counting on advertising to recoup its investment. It also planned to raise rates eventually. But Settles says the plan cost too much and brought in too little.
Ultimately, the vendor has to make money for what they've sold to the community. I mean, anyone who says that, you know, oh, well, this should be this benevolent thing that the city does, well, that's great, but somebody has to pay for that.
Under the new Wi-Fi model, cities like New York City, Corpus Christi, and Oklahoma City start small, using the internet for municipal business where it can reduce costs before rolling it out to the public. They're also investing in their own systems. Santa Monica spent $500,000 to build its own fiber optic network about 5 years ago. It's using its system to do things like synchronize traffic lights and cut down on legwork for police officers and other public employees. Jory Wolf runs Santa Monica's system.
We were able to take that network and the $500,000 investment and almost make our money back in year one. We've saved a bundle of money.
And made a bundle. Santa Monica leases its fiber optic network to businesses at lower prices than private companies offer. Wolf says that's bringing new business to the city. So is free public internet access.
At first, the public Wi-Fi piece was going to be sort of like a giveaway. We didn't see it as really integrated in with our entire solution, but then we saw how important it was getting businesses to buy in.
And the incentives for businesses are growing now that most consumers have gone wireless with iPhones, BlackBerries, and laptops. Glenn Fleischman is the editor of Wi-Fi Network News.
4 years ago, when everyone was talking about putting Wi-Fi across the city, it was not that compelling. But today, it's network for these purposes and network for these devices.
Fleischman says free Wi-Fi can draw people to areas where they'll spend money at local businesses. He says that could encourage more cities with municipal broadband to go public. Back on the 3rd Street Promenade in Santa Monica, law student Bud Jerky and roommate Jason Rizzi worked their laptops over coffee at a local cafe where they plan to become regulars.
I'm just here for the summer, so I don't really want to sign a contract for a plan. Don't really have the money for it. Yeah. So
makes you want to come back here.
In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, it comes to us from the current issue of the journal Management Science, but you probably don't need an academic paper to convince you of this, that many CEOs in this country have overinflated opinions of themselves. Researchers at the University of Iowa looked at mergers and acquisitions specifically. They found that CEOs overestimate their own negotiating skills when arranging big deals, which in turn leads to more big deals, a good many of which don't actually add value to anybody. Executives pay the price themselves, too. Seems they adjust their own stock holdings, overconfidently assuming that the deals are, in fact, going to work out. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow lost 205 points, 1 2/3% as investors tried to figure out what Ben Bernanke is going to do about interest rates. The NASDAQ rolled down 54 points, 2 1/4%. The S&P 500 shook off 22 points. That's 1 2/3% there as well. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, the dirty work of tanning leather.
When I did smell that,
I felt like puking for 2-3 days.
Our series Working goes to Pakistan. I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.